Let's go on to chapter 4. Chapter 4 and 5 give us the feeling of annoyance by the Sadducees in particular, because and the priests who served with them, because Peter and the others were so boldly preaching the resurrection, which they denied, and because of that preaching, what they stood for was being undercut. And because the Sadducees did control the temple worship, they were in a position with their temple guard to bring Peter and others forward if they needed. And so they were indeed arrested, as verse 3 points out, and brought into custody. But notice, again, Luke has one of those new tabulations. The number of men who were people of faith grew to about 5,000 by this point already. Jerusalem is mushrooming from 3,000 to 5,000 in a relatively brief period of time. So they confront him. Verse 6 speaks about Annas, the father of the high priestly clan, who had many of his relatives put into the high priesthood, including Caiaphas, his son, and others who are mentioned here, and ask him, by what power did you do this? Peter, filled with the Spirit, says what he says, that it's in the name of Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified, that God raised him from the dead, and by his power, the man whom you crucified, this was done. And verse 12, this is a key verse for verse 12, there's salvation in no one else, no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. Alrighty, the attempt to shut them up didn't work very well, even though they were considered to be uneducated common people. They couldn't deny, as verse 16 says, that a notable sign had been performed, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem were very impressed by all that. They couldn't deny it. Let's warn them, zip your lip, quit talking about this, and you'll be okay. We'll let you go. And their response, no way, Jose, you know, we should listen to God, not to you, and we can't but speak of that which we have seen and heard. There's no way to quiet us down. And because they feared the people were in great numbers. Their numbers, as the religious leaders, their number was small. So they let them go and cross their fingers, hoping for the best for their team. Didn't work that way. Nevertheless, the disciples and the faithful ones were very, very concerned. Great fear came upon them. I suppose that's a fair way of describing this. And they joined together in prayer. Here is a very serious prayer, a prayer for boldness that's given to us in the last part of chapter 4. And there is a quotation of one of the prophets again. I'm sorry, the prophecy that's found in Psalm 2. And it does reflect upon what's happening in the Christian church there, the persecution that's presently the case. And there's a lot of history here recited about Pontius Pilate and so forth. But long and short of this, they prayed for boldness. And they continued to ask for signs and wonders. And the place is shaken, as verse 31 says. And you're reminded a little bit of Pentecost, where the place was shaken by the power of the Spirit. And so apparently their prayer is answered and they're strengthened through that prayer. And there's kind of a new Pentecost here. And it shows itself in that they shared with each other, had all things in common, and supported the poor. Those who had lands sold them and shared the proceeds. And the name that stands out here at the end of chapter 4 is the name of Barnabas. Barnabas is given as the exemplar of this kind of generosity in that he laid the proceeds of the sale of his property at the apostles' feet, and he is given a beautiful title here, the Son of Encouragement. I would like to say a word or two about this Barnabas person. I'm sure that as you read how he is involved throughout the book of Acts, you come to admire him as a very special kind of a man, because he not only was so generous to these poor people at the early time in the church when, you know, Perhaps they were guests for a few weeks while they learned more about Jesus before they went back home. Anyway, he shared of his own means. But later, he also introduced Saul, now Paul, well, later would be called Paul, to the people in Jerusalem, when the people in Jerusalem didn't know what to make of him because he'd been their persecutor just previously. And then later, he sort of takes John Mark under wing when Paul decides that I've had it with John Mark because he dropped out on the first missionary journey and I don't want to take a chance on him for the second missionary journey. And so Barnabas takes his cousin, his younger cousin, John Mark, along, and he becomes a very valuable person in the early history of the church, not only to Barnabas, but also to Peter, who later calls him, quote, my son, and to Paul, who later refers to him as being profitable to me for ministry. And of course, you'd know the rest. He also wrote the gospel, according to Peter, as we have it, and we were benefited by that. So John Mark, the young man who had a little bit of growing need, and here we have Barnabas who helped him through that. And I think that's such an important lesson, that sometimes young people will make a bad judgment call, but we can't give up on them simply because of one bad judgment call. They may have a great potential if they are nurtured by those who care about them, as Barnabas was able to do and did. Now, the opposite of Barnabas is given us in chapter 5, where we have Ananias and Sapphira listed here as selling their property, holding back some of it, and suggesting that they gave all the proceeds of the sale. And as Peter explains, there was nobody who said you had to give it all, but if you said we gave it all and you didn't, that's a lie. And guess what? They lied and died, just like that. Sounds like a pretty heavy penalty, right? Can any of you explain why this was such a severe penalty?
Luke? Lied to the Holy Spirit.
Okay. That's how it's explained here. And do you think people normally get this heavy of a penalty for lying? I hope not.
One of the first instances of it in the church.
There you go.
And they had to make an example of them.
Exactly. This is a foundational moment. And we have a parallel to that in the Old Testament. Remember when Joshua first came into the land after these 40 years of wandering under Moses, and then Joshua led them across the Jordan, and the very first city they went to was Jericho, and we have this one man who kept some of the holy things which were supposed to be given to the service of the Lord for himself, and he hid them in his tent. Achan was his name, and they lost the next battle at Ai simply because God was not with them at this particular point, because they had been disloyal to his command, and they needed to flush out this sin before they could again have his presence and the victories that would follow. So Achan's family was stoned together with Achan because 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, they surely needed to have learned the lesson of fidelity to God, who gave them the land after many, many years of the promise, as a pivotal moment, a foundational moment. And so here, got to get this church off on the right foot. So it becomes basically an example. And that explains, I think, the severity of the penalty to the two. Now, there is an interesting little vignette about Peter in verse 12 and following. Apparently, he was so revered and so effective through the power of the Spirit. Verse 15 suggests that people even carried their sick to where he was, and to be near Peter, so that perhaps his shadow might fall on them, and even his shadow might be the way in which they might be cured and healed. And that kind of thing is replicated once again in chapter 19. If you were able to read this far for today, you discovered that people brought handkerchiefs to Paul, that he might touch the handkerchiefs so that, you know, those who they were might be healed. And so the brief summary of these kinds of events is that God gave extraordinary powers to his agents at this time of planting the church. Peter and Paul both participated in this, Peter primarily among the Jews and Paul primarily among the Gentiles. And that's related to, well, the kind of thing that Jesus was able to do and did according to the Gospels. People just touched the hem of his garment, and well, like this woman with the 12-year issue of blood, for example. So God did not hold back when he commissioned his people to go forward as his direct agents at this seminal moment of the time of the planting of the church. He also gave them authority and power, and signs and wonders attended this time of the planting of the church. It must have been an electric time to be alive. But once again, chapter 5 continues with the Sadducees getting all upset. The high priest gets up and gets agitated, and they're jealous because of the success of the apostles. And once again, they end up being jailed or imprisoned, whatever word you want to use there. And here we have a unique situation, at least up to now, is that the angel opens the prison doors and releases them, so that the next morning they're in the temple already at daybreak preaching, and when the chief priests seek to summon them, they're not in the prison, and they have to find them in the temple. So the common people, of course, are very excited about this kind of thing, but the Sadducees and their officers can't do much about it because they are afraid. Verse 26 says they're afraid of being stoned by the people. See, you have this dichotomy. On the one hand, the religious leaders oppose with all their might and means and methods, but the common people are excited about how God is working through them. So the Sadducees are limited in what they can do. Nevertheless, they express their concern in chapter 5. They are afraid that Jerusalem will be filled with their teaching and our blood will be upon us because the Romans will come and destroy us. They have certainly not a very good understanding of what the kingdom of Jesus was about, but through their misunderstanding, of course, they seek to blot him out, but they fail. In this connection, verse 34 introduces a name of a person that I think you should remember. His name is Gamaliel. And Gamaliel was one of the wisest men of his time. We find out later that he also was one under whom Saul had studied in his youth. When Saul was educated, at least part of his education came under Gamaliel. He very possibly studied elsewhere as well, but he studied under Gamaliel, and so he could boast of being a Hebrew of the Hebrews. He'd been well schooled in their traditions. So Gamaliel stands up in defense of the apostles. Well, at least to the point of telling the Sadducees to back off. Because he says, if indeed this movement is of God, we cannot resist it. And if it's not from God, they will fail. And he gives an example, two examples actually, that of two previous revolutionaries named Thutis and, not surprisingly, Judas. Thutis, verse 36, gathered 400 men in a revolution, and he was killed, and those who followed him were dispersed. They came to nothing. And later, Judas the Galilean, not to be confused with Judas Iscariot, rose in the days of the census, and he likewise perished, and those with him. And so that was obviously not from God, and God took care of them. So God will take care of these guys too, if indeed they're not of God. So they backed off a little bit, and they beat him up a little bit, verse 40, and told them to not speak about Jesus. And guess what happens, verse 41? The apostles rejoiced because they were counted worthy of suffering for his name. As Jesus suffered for his fidelity, now they're on the same team. They've gotten their stripes too for that fidelity. And every day they continued preaching in the temple. It didn't stop. And that's a beautiful, beautiful way in which the first portion of this book concludes.